Welcome to The Trauma Tapes. I'm Dr. MC McDonald, a PhD trauma researcher, author, and life coach. I'm here with my sister, Elizabeth Meadows. On this podcast, we read your letters, give you advice, and help you heal without shame. Before we get into this week's episode, I have a really exciting announcement. I wrote a book. It's called Unbroken: The Trauma Response is Never Wrong, and it is available for pre-order right now. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of your indie bookstores, wherever you buy books. It's about trauma, the trauma response, shame, and how to heal. I can't wait for you to read it, and I can't wait to hear what you think.
Welcome to The Trauma Tapes. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? What's new?
I'm good. What's new? It was the marathon week here in Boston. Just always like fun.
10-year anniversary, speaking of
trauma. I know.
I listened to a podcast about that, and I was like, holy shit, I forgot.
You were like, that was the first year that I was gone and you were like in the middle of it.
Yeah. We were on
the
floor
right there
in Cambridge. Like that was, so for people who don't know, the Boston Marathon bombing happened 10 years ago. And then there was this, a series of events that were really awful. There was a student from MIT who went missing and got pinned as the Boston Marathon bomber because we had these like these videos from some CCTV somewhere. And then there was a chase, a high speed, or not a high speed chase. There was a, they were looking for the two people, the two kids.
Right.
And, it happened in Cambridge, which is where I was living at the time. And like, we were in a lockdown because they were looking through people's backyards. They knew that these two were in the area, but they didn't know where. And so we were like up all night, literally on the floor of the apartment. And there were like cops and people running down the streets and looking in backyards. And like, cause Cambridge has these, all these apartments have these little nestled backyards together. It's kind of a jungle.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying. People and cops were coming into people's apartments. Like it was like, they, it was intense.
It really, it was, and you were blocks away from like,
literally a half a block from where the
carjacking.
They carjacked somebody and then the guy got out at the gas station. That gas station was like 300 feet from my apartment.
Yeah. There's a Netflix thing on it, like three episodes and it's.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And like, I watched the first one. I'm like, why am I doing this? Like what? But
it, I know.
There were kind of some like details that you didn't know about at the time that you kind of learned and, you know, just an absolute tragedy. And, to think that it's been 10 years, you know, it's pretty crazy. It is a very like meaningful, special day in Boston. And I feel like it's kind of gotten back there, which is
oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it always has been. It was before that. So we got a reader question, actually not a letter this week about, they just said, can you please talk about the default mode network? Do you know what this is?
Well, you sent me an article before, so I'm a little bit familiar with it now, but I had never heard of it.
This is like the only time I was like, I think we want to talk about this before the actual recording of the podcast. Usually I just tell Lisa like as we are starting.
Here you go.
Hey, we're going to talk about this. So the default mode network is when we talk about the brain, part of the reason why I really wanted to answer this question is because there is so much misinformation and weird stuff out there about the brain that makes it sound so simple and is so overly reductive that it's actually dangerous. And so we obviously can't in a podcast, you know, give an exhaustive account of anything when we're talking about the brain, but I think we can give a little bit more nuance because there's some harmful stuff out there. So when we talk about the brain, I know I've said this before, there's three ways you can talk about it. You can talk about the structures, like the areas, you can talk about the blood flow, and then you can talk about the electrical circuits. And so when you talk about the default mode network, you're talking about essentially all three. So there's a couple of areas of the brain. The first kind of work on the default mode network came out, I think, in the early 2000s. So pretty soon after we started looking at the brain in imaging studies. And that's not that long, but it's also not just right now. So one of the things I see out there is that like we've just discovered the default mode network. Like, no, that's not true. And like with any thing in neuroscience, all of this is up for debate because we're currently figuring it out. And so it's not like here are 10 facts that we know for sure that we'll always know. These are hypotheses and theories about what's going on. So the brain areas involved seem to be very similar actually to the Mohawk of self-awareness, which we've talked about in a previous episode last season. So if you're interested in that, you can go back there. But the medial prefrontal cortex, which is in charge of decision-making, habit formation, attention, working memory, the posterior cingulate cortex, which is involved in regulating your emotions and monitoring conflict and decision-making, and then the middle temporal lobe, which includes the amygdala and the hippocampus. So that's fear, motivation, and then long-term memory. Neuroscientists are putting these areas together because they seem to be involved in knowing yourself as a self. Autobiographical memory, ideas about the self, like what we call the ego, tends to be involved in these brain structures. And we know that because when you put someone in an fMRI machine, which is a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, and you're looking at blood flow in the brain, when you give them a task, a lot of the blood flow and electrical activity goes to the prefrontal cortex. When you don't give them a task and you just ask them to sit there, they have no devices, they have nothing to do, their brain starts to kind of wander. And that's when all of these structures light up. And so putting together what we know, we think that like this circuit, this set of structures that like come together in these particular moments are there to sort of like, there's a psychiatrist, Matthew Brown, who says that like this part of the brain is supposed to remind you that you are you, if that makes sense. There are two other hypotheses. So that's like the basics. Does that make sense? That whole thing. Yeah. And then there's two places that there's a bunch of more current research. And one of them is about how and in what ways the default mode network is active in mental illness or underactive. And so they think that it's overactive when you have depression, anxiety, and OCD, which can contribute to these ruminating thoughts or like rigid patterns about who you are, these kind of automatic negative thought loops about yourself. It's also involved in research about what they're calling a pivotal brain experience, which I want to come back to in a second. But the other piece of brain science that we need to know is that neurons are like, you know, like when they do a true crime, like map on the wall and they're trying to like connect dots and they put the red string between the two pins. Yeah. Neurons are like the little pins. And then there's neural connectivity, which is the red string. And the more often neuron A goes to neuron B, the tighter the string gets. And so if you have this default belief about yourself, let's say you have OCD or you have a rigid thought pattern about like that you're a loser or something, whenever you're in this state of like your mind wandering, you're going to go to these ruminating thoughts. And the more you go to them, the tighter those connections get and the faster they move. The phrase in neuroscience for this, which probably everyone has heard, is that neurons that fire together wire together. So like they get super connected. Yeah. And so the trick when you're trying to treat someone who has OCD or depression or just a negative thought pattern or ruminating thought is how do you disconnect those automatic connections?
Yeah.
And so this is where this stuff comes in about a pivotal brain experience, which is when you essentially, like I've heard it talked about as like, it's a similar thing to when you like defragment your computer, defrag, right? I don't know computer stuff, but like, it's like you're turning the power on and turning it back on to like reset the thing. And the point is that you shake up the connections so that they can make new connections. And so a pivotal brain experience is when you give yourself an opportunity to have a brief time of like hyperplasticity. So your brain can kind of forge new connections.
Okay.
The thing that I'm seeing that worries me a lot is that there seems to be this very reductive account of all of this. And in particular, this idea of like giving yourself a pivotal brain experience that says that the only way to do this is by doing psychedelics. And that's problematic. Psychedelics, they think there's a lot of upcoming research and we've been looking at psychedelics in terms of trauma and things since like the 1970s. So this is also not new. It's becoming more common to talk about because the laws are getting a little bit more lax in certain places, which means more research studies can happen. There's very promising research about the use of psychedelic in clinical settings, in clinical dosages, with scaffolding therapeutic benefits around it to change things that get really, really fixed and stuck, like intractable depression, PTSD, and OCD. It is not a one-size-fits-all cure, and it is not the same as doing psychedelics in your friend's basement without any of that other scaffolding. And so I think the thing that I'm seeing that's really harmful is that people are saying, okay, well, psychedelics equal pivotal brain experience equals good. I just need to do this one time and everything will be fixed.
It's making me think of like electroshock therapy.
Yeah, which is also still a thing.
But that would be termed a pivotal brain experience, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't actually know. I'd have to look that up. I know that it shakes up the electrical connections, the circuitry in your brain, and it's used typically for like the most intractable depression. It's almost never like a frontline, like here's the first thing you're going to do. But if you have depression and nothing else is working and you have multiple suicide attempts, they will do electroshock therapy to attempt to kind of reset your system. Yeah. So it probably
and does it work?
It does, yes, but not always. Nothing works always.
Like, and is it a one and done?
No. Typically when you do electroshock therapy, and this is also true for psychedelics, it's like a 3 or 4 month span where you have a reduction of symptoms. And so like some of the studies that I've seen on psychedelics are really, really promising because it's like 80% of the participants had a reduction of symptoms for 3 or 4 months. That's huge, but it's not 100%, and it's 3 or 4 months. And again, it's in a clinical setting where you have a scaffolded therapeutic model around the medication. It's not just like drop some acid and move on with your life or do ayahuasca with some person who's pretending to be a shaman. And, you know, that's all you need. That's really, right. I have seen people who end up, and I don't mean to be fear-mongering. I just think it's really important. I have had clients who have gone to things like this to try to heal their trauma and end up with worse trauma. I've also seen clients who end up in an institution to deal with the repercussions of the trip that they had. So we need to be careful with this because we are kind of, you know, messing with these critical parts. So one of the things that psychedelics do is give you, you know, this is called ego death. You lose your sense of self. And so this is one of the reasons why we hypothesize that like you're getting a pivotal brain experience because like all of these structures that are in charge of knowing yourself as a self, recognizing that you are you, get reset. And you can see that because people are having this, you know, shared experience of ego death. But ego death without like a scaffolded therapeutic thing behind it can be incredibly traumatic.
Right. And the scaffolded therapeutic thing behind it would involve what?
Integration session. So first of all, when you do it in a clinical setting, there's a team with you to help handle what happens if things go sideways. And so they have medications that they can give you to counter a negative experience. They can help guide you. They provide support. I had a friend actually who did one of these trials on OCD. This is a long time ago, and had a terrible experience with the psychedelic. But the team was so therapeutic that actually helped him with some other issues about trusting human beings. So you have a team of doctors who are there and trained to help you if things go badly. And then also if things don't go badly, or if they do, you have follow-up sessions to integrate the experience. And that is not what's going to happen if you're doing this in a setting that's just a casual setting. I don't know what else to call like that other kind of setting. Non-clinical. I don't know.
Just, it feels like, and you know, I'm going to get shit for this, but like looking for a quick fix, like, you know?
Yeah.
It feels risky and it feels, which could also be part of the behavior before is risky. Yeah. So it feels like an extension of that. And it feels like you're looking for a quick fix.
And we're back. It's been 7 days since we were in the middle of that conversation about the default mode network. Thanks to PG&E, who turned my power off for the entire day for no reason. Well, I'm sure there was a reason. I didn't get to know what it was.
They don't share those reasons with you.
They do not. They are doing very important power line stuff on a weekday. Well, I mean, yeah, the reason that they're having to do this stuff is because they didn't maintain their stuff. And that's why there are so many, one of the main reasons there's so many fires in California is not just because of the climate change, but also that PG&E didn't like do what they were supposed to be doing, what we were paying them to be doing for all these years.
So they have to go back and do maintenance and fix little pieces. So they come in and they turn your power off to fix a piece of something. And the power could be off for 10 minutes. It could be off for 3 days. You have no idea what's happening.
That's infuriating.
And you're still paying for it too.
And there's no warning. So you can't like plan around it.
Nope. And you're just like, oh, cool. I didn't have anything to do on this weekday. Like,
right. When I have 9,000 things scheduled.
Right. Thanks. Great.
That require electricity.
Right. Yeah. I didn't need to shower or like make food or like be at work. It's frustrating. Okay. So we were talking about the default mode network.
Yes. We were talking about psychedelics a lot. And my next question to you is, how are those two things related? Do you need to take psychedelics in order to access the default mode network?
No.
Okay.
And I think this is one of the, this is like, we always do this in society. We're like, okay, here's this kind of new thing that everyone's talking about. I want to talk about EMDR in a second with this, but here's this new thing. I have to do it. It will be the magic bullet. I'm going to cure all my things. I'm just going to go do a bunch of acid by myself or with a stranger, like not in a clinical setting. And, it's really important that you pay attention to the research. So there's two things that I want to say. One is that the way that you do psychedelics really, really matters. You can't just like use psychedelics and then like shake up your default mode network. You need to be in a scaffolded situation because what psychedelics do, they think, is create, they shake up the default mode network and create a situation of what they call hyperplasticity, where you can then make changes in the way that you see yourself and the world and, you know, work with any narratives that are like stuck. But you can't do that if you don't have a therapist who's helping you integrate the experience. So it's not just the psychedelic experience. It's also the way that that experience gets contextualized and integrated in your larger life, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah.
It's also really important that you do this in a clinical setting. I can't remember if I talked about this last week, did I?
A little bit, but it's
good to
revisit. Yeah.
Because they can help you when, if the situation goes sideways, they have protocols and plans and other medications to help you. If you start having a bad experience, if you go to some random stranger's basement, they do not have that capability. And so you can end up having a second trauma on top of the trauma that you're trying to treat. But that's just the psychedelic thing. The default mode network is just there and it's active anytime you're not doing anything like concentrated. Whenever you let your mind wander, your default mode network is like doing stuff and it's activated, and we can see that in brain scan stuff. So the more space you can give yourself in a day where you're not picking up a device and scrolling, reading, doing something to distract yourself, the more connectivity you're going to get in your default mode network. When you want to like shake it up, there are other things you can do that accomplish that that are not psychedelics. So one of the things that they know, and I think there's going to be a lot more research on this in the upcoming years. One thing that they know shakes up the default mode network is travel. And so when you're in a different place, if you think about what that means, number one, you're paying attention to details in a way that you're not when you're at home. And two, you're sort of like reorienting yourself in the world, which requires a lot of connectivity and activity in the default mode network and shakes up those like those hardwired connections a little bit. And so there's lots of stuff you can do that's going, anything that's going to make you feel like that is probably also going to reset the default mode network. They've done a ton of research on the experience of awe, which also does the same thing. Because again, you can think about like if you, I don't know if you have a situation where you felt awe recently, but like if you're looking at the night sky in a different way, in a different place, and you see all these stars you never saw before, you sort of like resituate yourself in the world. Yeah. It gives you perspective. And so anything that gives you awe and anything that kind of gets you out of your situation and puts you into another situation is going to accomplish something similar. It's not going to necessarily be as intense as a psychedelic experience, but that may be a good thing, you know?
So could you say that it's just paying attention in a different way or a more present way than you were before?
Yeah.
I mean, would that, And is the world we live in just trying to obliterate the default phone network?
Yeah. I mean, I think it does in a lot of ways, because we don't let our minds wander. We never let ourselves get bored. We don't engage often in like artistic creativity where you have to sort of like, you know, adapt in the moment based on the medium you're working with and your ideas that you're having. It's, we don't let ourselves sit in anything.
Right. And if you can just focus on one thing, like we've talked about cooking in the past or being in nature or, I mean, is it just kind of eliminating a lot of the other noise that we allow in all the time? If you, for example, if you're cooking, you're focused on cooking, does that activate the default mode network, or do you have to be like in a meditative like state? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think so. There's a couple like things that are getting conflated. So when you're cooking, you're using a lot of your prefrontal cortex. And so you are kind of rewiring your brain away from fear, because you need your working memory to be able to cook. Like there's nothing actually that requires more of your working memory than like remembering that the recipe said a quarter cup between when you're looking at the book and when you open the drawer. I don't know why that takes so much concentration, but it does. That's the same thing with Tetris. That's the same thing with EMDR. You're manually pushing blood flow and electrical activity into the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex, part of it is active in the default mode network, but there's a whole bunch of other structures that are involved that actually need less focused attention to get activity to. So if you think about daydreaming, or like when your mind is wandering, so if you imagine yourself standing in the grocery store line, and instead of picking up your phone and scrolling through Instagram or texting five people or whatever, if you just let your mind wander, that's going to be the thing that activates the default mode network. So it's like presence, but not that focused attention that you have when you're like cooking or playing Tetris or doing stuff like that. Those are beneficial to get your alarm system to quiet down, but it's not fully like the default mode network. The protocol that people are talking about all the time, I'm getting really tired of the word protocol, by the way, is non-sleep deep rest, which is essentially non-meditation. This is so interesting. I talked for years about steering clear of the meditation trap. We've talked about this before. Meditation is not for everyone. It's contraindicated is not a word, if you have anxiety and PTSD, because it can tend to just amplify those feelings, or there's a possibility that it will amplify those feelings. And so non-sleep deep rest is specifically not meditation, and it's specifically not sleeping. It's basically letting your mind wander, not having a focused stimuli that you're paying attention to, just kind of letting yourself be. But think about when was the last time you did that?
Well, I'm trying to when I used to do acupuncture, like that was an extended period of time.
Yeah.
And it worked because you have needles in you and you can't get up and
you can't move. Exactly.
Right.
Or go do something else.
Do anything else. And then the second thing that came to mind immediately, and we talked about this too, was watching Frasier, like watching reruns.
Yes.
You didn't have to knew what was going to happen, and it was on in the background, and I wasn't on the phone or a device.
Yep.
And just kind of like, those are two very different examples, but.
No, but that's a great, I think it's so interesting that, people are always talking about watching reruns, like the benefit that gives you for that exact reason, which is that you're like, it's really comforting to have something that you know in the background, but that you don't have to pay tons of attention to follow the storyline, because it's like super scary or compelling or, you know, like,
yeah,
that's
showering,
so
I guess, is another like example.
Yeah, for sure. I was, I'm bad at this because I don't like it. I don't like sitting and letting my mind wander. I want to be doing things and having ideas and having, you know, new information coming in. And that's, I need to be careful because I get fried and then my brain stops working. But, cause so when I'm in the shower, I'm listening to a podcast usually, and I'm like learning stuff and getting information. And it's like, no, like, you know, when you were a kid and you just learned to drive and you're driving alone and you're like listening to your music and you're like thinking about school and your outfit and your boyfriend and your friend and your family and this other thing, like that is the thing that is going to be mind wandering. You know, we don't really do it anymore.
We don't do it anymore. And that's so funny you say that thing about music, because there's music that really like brings back great memories of mom. And, you know, and it's only in those moments, you know, it's not all the stuff that I've kept, you know, since she passed away that I think means mom to me. It's there's nothing better than the memories that come forward when I hear James Taylor, Mexico. Like that's,
yeah,
like, that just, so listening to music, driving in the car is like can be a great, space to let those things kind of bubble up.
Totally. And then if you think about that situation, like you can kind of feel, not like in a physical way, but like you can feel what your mind is doing.
Yeah.
Because it's like going into the past, the hippocampus is part of the default mode network, part of the amygdala. You're accessing emotion, you're accessing the memory, you're thinking about yourself in the present. What would it be like if she was here now? But you know, like all of these different things that you don't get when you have like a laser focus on something.
Right. And I also think about that with drive. I like driving. I like being in the car. I like taking a drive, you know, and this tendency, and I do it all the time, to use Waze all the time, even when I know where I'm going. Like,
I know,
it takes me out of the joy of driving, of the, like being able to like kind of zone out a little bit. And, you know, I don't need to look at the screen to find out that it's, you know, 17 minutes till I get to where I'm going. Like, I know where I'm going. I know how to get there. Like, why am I doing, like, what's the...
It's like, alert, there's 4 seconds of traffic coming up.
I know. It kind of, like, takes the joy out. And what can be an enormously helpful tool, and I'm glad that it exists, but I don't need it when I'm running errands to places that I know where they are. You know?
Right. So, just going to CVS and then coming back.
Right.
Not a big
thing. I don't need a blow by blow.
Right.
It's going to happen.
Oh, there's a tire in the road here. Someone found a can by the side of the road. Exactly. This trip is going to take you 65 seconds longer than it usually does. Bah!
Right. Why don't you turn 75 times before you get there? Right. And that will help. No, that's going to stress me up.
Yeah, exactly. Could we be in maximum stress all the time, 24/7? Is that possible?
Right. Right. So anyway, that's related but unrelated, you know. I guess trying to recognize the default mode network and appreciate it, and
there's two things. Like there's the spending time in it, kind of accessing it, being in it at like, you know, increasing connectivity, and then there's shaking it up. And number one, like, so being in it more, I think, will make you feel more connected to yourself, which then makes it easier to be in the world. And so if you can like carve out even 20 minutes a day where you're doing something that enables you to let your mind wander that isn't meditation, then that's going to help you kind of upkeep your connectivity to that part of your brain, which just is going to make you feel better. But then when it comes to shaking it up, not everyone needs their default mode network shaken up. If you're struggling with depression, anxiety, intrusive thoughts, fixed narratives that don't serve you about experiences that are in the past, then look to the experience of awe first. What brings you awe, and can you incorporate that in your life on a semi-regular basis? So this is such a dorky thing, but like I love being in a museum, and not for like a 5-hour audio tour, whatever the hell. Like I want to like do a quick like cruise through the museum and see what is so inspiring, what really like catches my attention. Like that is an experience of awe. Like going on a camping trip and looking at the stars in a different way is an experience of awe. You know, we don't always need to turn to the most extreme example in order to shake up the default mode network. And when we talk about travel, you know, someone's going to email and talk about not everyone can travel, you know, travel, like take a different walking route to the grocery store. Like it doesn't have to, we don't have to get angry about this and make it a thing. If you can travel in a way that's a little bit bigger, cool. If you can't, that doesn't mean it's not available to you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just changing your perspective.
Yeah. Getting that experience. We all know that experience of wonder and awe that like, and you can feel it in those moments. Like, I have a friend who has a telescope and we were looking at the stars, and I've never really looked through a telescope. The stars like move, like they sort of wave. And I was like, what the, like, why did I not know this? You know, and I was so fascinated by it. And it just like, when you have that experience, you like, you land in the world in again, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, just a little perspective shift a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So,
it's accessible.
Yes. All of it. Yep.
That's good.
Yeah. So that's that. The thing I wanted to say about EMDR also is that like, I've been seeing increasingly people talk about like, oh, I did an EMDR and it didn't work and therefore I'm broken. And it's like, okay, we have now metabolized this story that if that EMDR is the treatment for trauma, and if it doesn't work in two sessions, you're fucked up. Like, can we look at things with like, just like 6 ounces more of nuance? Like, it's a tool in the toolbox. It may help in some ways. It may not help. It's a tool. Just like if you had a house project and you had a whole bunch of tools, you might like different ones, you know what I mean, for different things. There are some tools that are totally inappropriate for other projects. Like, that doesn't mean you're doing it wrong or the tools are fucked up. It means like, you need a different thing. You're trying to like, you know, screw something in with a hammer. Not going to work. Like,
right.
Right. And EMDR
today.
Right. EMDR. I just want to talk about Francine Shapiro for a second. I was teaching about this on Monday. This is why I'm thinking of it. But I think it reveals this like temptation that we have to find a magic bullet. There's not one for anything. No. Sorry. The quicker you can realize that, the easier your life is going to get. But EMDR was discovered basically by accident. It was super controversial for like 25 years. It was not just discovered. Francine Shapiro spent her entire life advocating for it. Mm-hmm. And at no point did anyone say it was going to like cure everything. It's a tool.
That is the big, like, that's where we get into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, like you said,
mm-hmm.
there's no magic bullet.
Right.
You know?
Right. And like, I know that's painful. I wish there was a magic bullet for a lot of things, you know, but
there's quicker, a lot of grace when you realize there isn't one.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the quicker you realize that, the less like painful your life is going to be, because I think what happens is when you believe something is a magic bullet and then you try it and it isn't, the thing you then turn to immediately is shame.
Right.
And that's just not, right. No.
But it's also the Cinderella that you find, if you find your partner, if you find your other person, it's going to be great. And, you know, happily ever after. Nope. It's not the way it works.
Nope. False. Yeah, totally.
You know?
Yeah.
Whatever you think you're missing is not going to solve your problems. No. You know,
we do it with everything.
We do. And then we get frustrated and then we get upset. And if we could just have a little bit more grace and acceptance, life wouldn't feel so difficult.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I say this all the time, but like when I first started giving papers and stuff about trauma, like every person would be like, what are you going to do when we have a magic bullet? Like, I'll do something else if we ever find a magic bullet. But also like, how does that question make sense?
Right.
What have we ever found a magic bullet for?
Nothing.
The common cold? Nope.
Right.
Like,
right. Pain? No.
Yeah. I mean, and if we do get there someday, I will happily eat my shoe and be wrong. Like, that's not the point, you know?
Right.
But yeah.
Because even if there is like some cure or something that works or makes you feel better, it doesn't change that it's part of your story.
Totally.
You know?
Totally. The lived experience is always going to be there. It's always relevant, you know, like.
Right. It's part of your journey. It's part of who you are. You can't excise it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Anywho.
Anywho, so that's that. That's the default mode network.
Thank you.
Yeah. Random, but what a cool thing. Like every time I like research a thing, I feel like I, you know, and people make fun of me because it's always dark stuff, but then I'm like, oh, but look at this.
Right.
Like how much hope is there in healing when like the thing that heals our brain is awe and wonder? Like that's fucking right. Cool.
It's beautiful.
Right? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
That's that. So yeah, I think it's really hopeful and exciting.
I do too.
Anyway, speaking of those things like that, do you have a tiny little joy?
Yeah. Mine is, I had another one. I'll save the other one, but I was driving to the airport this morning, to drop Brent off. And I, do you have vocabulary that you only use in the car while you're driving that you
1000%
any other part of your life?
Yes. And it like, it amazes me the things that I say, cause I'm like, I'm not this person.
The words that I use in the car often are fucking douchebag. And I never use the word douchebag outside of the car, outside of driving. It is not in my normal life at all.
I'm picturing you becoming like a New York cabbie with like a cigar. You fucking douchebag.
And I say it out loud when no one's in the car. I was going through the tunnel, like coming back home, and I'm like, what are you doing, you fucking douchebag? Like, you never use that word in any other context. Like, what is a douchebag?
Oh, what's funny? The one that I use, I don't think I can even say, not in the car.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just amazing.
When I do the same thing. I know.
And then I just was laughing out loud. Like, listen to yourself.
There used to be this, this podcast called Reply All that I really loved. It was sort of like car talk for the internet and stuff. And it got canceled. And, but there was an episode, I can't even remember what this was, but they recorded, they were trying to, remember when they were talking about how you could like hack into the Samsung phone and like listen to everything that was happening, and Trump like didn't believe it. And he kept having a Samsung phone or some shit. And like, everyone was like, this is literally like a national security disaster because anyone who knows how to do anything can hack into your thing. So they were like trying to like debunk that. And so they gave Alex, the host, this phone that they could hack into. And they hacked into it like while he was in his car driving by himself. And he's just like, do out loud. And then like he thinks of something funny and starts laughing. So he goes from like do fucking douchebag.
Maybe that's like our true self.
The way we can like bounce around is so funny.
It has to be like, it has something to do with how like you're in motion and the scenery's changing. Or I don't know. It's that's so funny.
It is funny. Oh my God.
Douchebag.
Fucking douchebag.
Is that a Massachusetts thing?
I don't know. Probably. The word that I say starts with a T and ends with a T.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've never.
Heard you say that word.
Right? I've never said that in my life. Does everyone do this?
I hope so.
Write in, let us know.
I've never heard you say that.
I don't know even where I learned it. Like, why is that a word that even appears in my horizon of words to choose, you know?
But it's good. It's like sharp. It's like to the point. It's like it gets the job done.
It's very pointed.
Oh my god,
my face hurts.
Ooh.
Okay. Mine is fun, is small and funny. And I can't remember if I did this already. But I started a tiny little joy practice on TikTok. Tell you this?
No.
So, I am on TikTok. It's mc.phd, which is, I'm too old for TikTok, but whatever. And I started doing tiny little joys as a practice every day. And so I will post something that's a tiny little joy, and then people come in the comments and they talk about their tiny little joys of the day. And it's like the most wholesome thing in the world. And nobody is like awful. I have some hilarious things people say on other videos. But I start, like, it's interesting having a group of tiny little joys because you start seeing other people's stuff.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So one of the things that someone talked about was like the, you know, when you pick up the dishwash soap, sometimes the, like the tiny little bubbles come out.
Yeah.
Someone mentioned that. And now every time it happens, I like laugh as if that person is like in the room. You know what I mean?
Oh, you like absorb their tiny little
joys. Do. Totally.
I love that.
It's so, yeah.
I have to ask you questions about TikTok.
Oh, okay. It's
definitely too old.
Oh no. It's TikTok is a wild place. I have someone who helps me with my social media, and we now spend like 5 or 10 minutes at the beginning of each meeting that we have talking about the most hilarious things that people come up with.
Yeah.
And it is like nobody has a filter, like between the thing that they think and then putting it out in the world, there's no space. So like, they just like will in all caps be like, "You're a sham." Like, you can't regulate your emotions. And you're like, what are you talking about? It's like hilarious. Someone got mad. I was talking about the Hope Circuit exercise, and my Hope Circuit go-to is always being a ballerina. And someone was like, "This is not body positive." And I was like, "Wow, guys." Like,
what do you mean? It depends on
I didn't say anything about body. I wasn't
assumptions about a ballerina.
It's my imagination. You don't get to cancel it. Like, what the fuck? You're a sham. Okay. What a hilarious, like, let's draw that out. What sham would this be? I went to school for like 55 years, went into incredible amounts of debt from which I will never recover to get a PhD so that I could post on a social media platform that didn't exist.
Yeah.
To help you feel more hopeful. What a sham, guys. Like, someone write a history book about this, because it is brilliant.
Oh God. People are silly.
They're so funny.
Maybe they don't drive anymore. Maybe that's like the fucking douchebag of the world now.
Fucking douchebag. In all caps. You're like, I just wanted to tell you about joy. You're a sham.
I'm just driving by.
Yeah. Oh God. It's like me and like I've pictured like a Volkswagen Bug with like the flower, you know, in the thing. There's like flowers all over it. I'm just driving by and people are like, "You're a sham." You're like, I just.
Everyone needs to get back into their bubble
Yeah.
of a car or whatever Yeah. it is. And like that needs to be the safe space, and you don't have to like launch it out in the world.
Say your terrible things in the safety of your own car where no one can hear you. But I will say that the tiny little joy side of TikTok is the most wholesome. There's no fuckery that goes on there. So come join me and share your tiny little joys. Because the other thing is, if you're having a hard day, you can go back through all the videos and you can scroll everybody's comments. And like, it's just delightful.
I love that. Okay. I need help with like how to like change my feed.
Oh yeah.
On TikTok the other day and got something that made me want to throw my phone out the window immediately.
What was it?
I can't talk about it.
Okay.
It's scary.
Yeah, you got to control the algorithm.
Oh, which my is God, I don't know why I got this thing, because it was like something I talked about in Florida and it heard me, and now it's like,
oh God.
It was terrible.
That's weird. Searching for stuff and then interacting with stuff that you love is the way to like get on your, and random shit will always pop up, but I always get like, I never get like scary or stuff that I don't like. It's always funny, silly stuff.
Okay. I think I filtered it, but I don't really know what the hell I'm doing.
Okay.
We'll talk. Do you like the goat thing I sent you the other day?
Yeah. There's this goat push the other goat off the little platform, and then he's like dancing around, like whoop, doo, 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 doo.
He was dancing around a Footloose,
right?
So he like blasted his friend goat off the deck, which is how you should deal with toxic people in your life.
Yeah, just like
and then do a dance
to Footloose.
Hello, for like a half an hour. Okay, we digress.
Yep. Okay. Anyway, rate, review, subscribe. That is the way to keep the podcast going. And send us an email at thetraumatapes@gmail.com. If you have a question or want your situation talked about by us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.